Morning, Chief Justice Steele, Justice Ridgely, Justice Berger. Adam Wendett for the appellant, Dallas Drummond. May it please the court. This is a two-issue appeal. The first issue being, was it proper for the court to allow the introduction of Mr. Drummond's testimony from his first trial at his second trial? Now, just as a factual background, at Mr. Drummond's first trial, at the conclusion of the state's case in chief, Mr. Drummond discharged his trial counsel. Trial counsel was not prepared to question Mr. Drummond. He wished to testify. Apparently, they had not discussed that before. Trial counsel was unprepared to question Mr. Drummond, so he discharged counsel and proceeded to testify. I'm sorry.
I must be confused. I thought that the reason that that counsel was discharged was because counsel was advising that he not testify, and Drummond wanted to testify.
Right.
But that it was not a question of lack of preparation on the part of counsel.
Well, I think there was a, you know, and I can't say for certain because I'm not trial counsel, and I don't know that the record fully reflects what happened. I think he was advised, Drummond was advised to not testify. And I think it was also a case that Mr. Dealey was not prepared to question Mr. Drummond. There was no preparation prior to the trial regarding his testimony.
Where in the record is there any evidence that he was not prepared to
I don't believe that that's fully reflected in the record.
It
would have to be. No. I think it would have to be an inference that's made from Mr. Drummond's decision to discharge his counsel.
I don't see how that inference is made. Go ahead.
Okay. In any event, Mr. Drummond discharged his counsel. That he was found guilty at the conclusion of the trial, and that case came before this court on appeal. On appeal, the case was remanded back to the conviction was overturned. The case was remanded back to the Superior Court. The reason being is that Mr. Drummond, in any event, did not properly discharge his counsel. He did not waive his right to counsel, and the court found that his Sixth Amendment rights were therefore violated. The case was remanded back for a second trial. So in the event, this court had decided that Mr. Drummond's Sixth Amendment right to counsel was denied at the point when he discharged his counsel improperly at the first trial. He testified after that improper waiver of counsel. He also did a closing argument without the assistance of counsel.
All right, what's the implications of that? So we sent it back on the theory that his counsel was not properly discharged. He went ahead and testified, gave a statement that now has been used against him in the second trial. What's the legal implication of that?
The legal implication is that at the time that Mr. Drummond testified, he did not have the assistance of counsel. It's not only that he didn't have effective assistance of counsel, he didn't have counsel at all. And he testified without the assistance of counsel. He made closing arguments without the assistance of counsel. The argument would be that the implication is that he didn't receive proper advice. He didn't receive proper counsel regarding what he should and shouldn't testify to, and how he should testify, what issues he should address during his testimony. He didn't receive counsel in that regard.
I thought he received counsel not to testify at all.
He received counsel not to testify at all, but when he made the decision to testify, the ultimate decision to testify would be his decision to do so. So in terms of his proposed testimony, He was advised not to testify, but when he chose to testify, he didn't receive any further counsel in that regard.
Does Harrison state the applicable rule here?
I think that Harrison can be distinguished from this case because Harrison was a Fifth Amendment issue, and this case presents a Sixth Amendment issue.
What is the rule then, that rule of law to be applied?
The general rule of law under Harrison would be that former trial testimony is admissible depending on the defendant's motivation for giving that testimony. The Harrison rule would state that if the defendant is compelled to testify by illegally introduced evidence, then his trial testimony would be barred from introduction in a subsequent trial.
But that's not the case here.
I would argue that that's not the case, Your Honor. I would argue that the Sixth Amendment issue is distinguishable.
Did the judge apply the Harrison test?
Yes, Your Honor.
And did you argue for a different test before the judge?
This was not my case at the trial level.
Did anybody argue for a different test?
I believe the state, in their motion to sever, they were arguing that it was a bright line rule that after the Sixth Amendment violation, and that since he was deprived of counsel from that point on, that anything from that point on would be inadmissible.
Assuming the Harrison test is the test to be applied, in other words, the question is not whether the petitioner made a knowing decision to testify, but why, was it correctly applied to the facts in this case?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe so, because I think it's distinguishable. Because if you ask the question why Mr. Drummond testified, he testified in the manner that he did. I think you have to look a little bit further. The manner that he testified in narrative form, without counsel. The reason why he did so is because his counsel advised him not to testify, and he didn't question him. He didn't have questions for him to testify. So why he testified, I would suggest to Your Honor, is that he was unhappy with his counsel's performance and that he had received ineffective assistance of counsel, which would change the issue. If his counsel advised him not to testify and didn't have any questions for him, and Mr. Drummond discharged him for that reason, because of the issues related to his testimony.
Counsel ineffective, it could well be, considering the result twice, that the best advice he could have gotten would have been not to testify.
Well, I would argue, Your Honor, that if Mr. Drummond, his trial counsel should have discussed with him prior to the trial whether he wanted to testify, and if Mr. Drummond was adamant about testifying, he should have prepared in such a manner, even if he was suggesting that he not testify.
But that's what the record's not clear on, as you told us earlier, correct? The extent to which counsel discussed with him the advice not to testify as opposed to Drummond's desire to testify?
Right, and I don't know that any record would be created on that with a trial counsel down in cell block talking to a defendant. There's some things that I don't know.
Well, one could argue, couldn't one, that a trial counsel who's carefully documenting what went on between him and his client would make a proffer to the court about the discussion that I advised my client not to testify over my advice, contrary to my advice, the defendant adamantly insists that he wants to testify. And counsel has to make the decision in a cook-like way about whether that's the defendant's right, regardless of the advice, and what counsel has to do accordingly, either withdraw or go along.
Right. I think that record.
We don't have any of that in the record.
I think that record should be made. And, you know, I don't think I'm in a position to say why that record wasn't made.
I appreciate that, but my only question is, we're clear, are we not, that there is no such record?
No.
We just don't know the answer to that.
No, there is no record of that. There's no definitive answer. It's only implications that can be made from the things that are on the record.
Sorry.
Go ahead.
Isn't it clear, at least this much, that your client said, okay, basically I just wanted to ask, is that it's my life that's on the line here, and I don't feel as though it's like properly correct to not let me speak to the courts and to the jurors. So I would really like to fire counsel at this moment. So didn't he fire his lawyer because his lawyer advised him not to testify and he wanted to testify against his lawyer's advice?
That's what the record reflects. That's what the record shows.
Well, then, doesn't that explain the answer to the question why he testified?
That's a difficult question, and I don't know if it's. I think it's back to the situation of we can't get in Mr. Drummond's head, we can't get in the trial court's head or the trial counsel's head. So that is a difficult question to answer from the record.
Well, did the trial judge answer it in this case? Isn't that what he concluded?
Yes.
Well, is that clearly erroneous?
I don't think it's clearly erroneous from the record.
Well, then aren't we bound by it?
I think that reasonable inferences can be made. Also, you know, I would suggest that the issue here is slightly different. It has to be looked at from a different perspective. And the question in a Sixth Amendment case should not necessarily be the same as in a Fifth Amendment case, where the issue is self-incrimination and where someone's motives to testify or not testify when it comes to self-incrimination, I believe should be looked at differently When you talk about someone's motives to testify or not testify when it comes to the right to counsel and advice of counsel, a different rule should be adopted for the Sixth Amendment issue.
Well, if it's the absence of counsel on the basis that counsel was improperly discharged in some way, despite what Justice Risley just read to you, which seems to answer the Harrison slash motivation question, what difference would it have made had counsel been properly discharged and either Mr. Drummond proceeded as he wished without counsel, or new counsel had been appointed for him? How would the result have been any different?
Well, there's some speculation there. I would say if new counsel had been appointed to him, that somebody would have prepared him and questioned him in a manner where he was simply responding to questions and not testifying in narrative form. His direct examination would have been limited. Would not have been as broad and expansive as his testimony that he gave.
That's a fair point. Is it clear from the record that he was insisting on a narrative, or that the narrative was essential because there was no one to ask him any questions?
Well, I think that the narrative at that point would have been essential, because after he had discharged counsel, he can't stand up there and, well, I guess he could, but would
they
be. You can't say it can't be a Bugs Bunny routine. He can't get up there and question himself and then move to the stand and answer. I don't think that would be practical. So his testimony, I think, would be markedly different if he had counsel.
Well, I didn't mean to improperly focus the point. The point was, if he said, I don't want a narrative, I want to be questioned by competent counsel, then there would have been some effort to obtain other counsel for him who would then be prepared to ask questions. But he wanted to move forward with a narrative, didn't he? That's the way he wanted to handle it.
I don't know if that's accurate. I don't know if that's accurate or not, from Mr. Drummond's perspective.
Well, let's assume, what's the status of evidence of guilt apart from his statement? Can one make the case that it doesn't really matter that this statement was admitted because there's overwhelming evidence of guilt otherwise?
Well, the state, if the case were remanded, went back to trial, or if they hadn't used the testimony in the second case, the state still had all of the evidence that they had at the start of the first trial. They had everything that they intended to present at the beginning of the first trial. So,
fair to say this wasn't a close case?
That's another question that's hard to answer too, because I think you could make an argument that it wasn't a close case, but then again, at the first trial he was found guilty of burglary, and at the second trial he was found not guilty of the burglary. So I think it could be argued either way. I would say that the mixed outcomes, the first trial he was found guilty of burglary in the second degree, the second he wasn't, that it was a close case.
Well, that also suggests the wisdom of counsel's original advice not to testify, doesn't it?
Why would that be?
Because he didn't testify in the retrial, and he was acquitted of burglary second degree.
Well, they still presented his testimony from the first trial. His same testimony was presented in both trials. So it's a little bit difficult to explain the outcomes of the two trials and why he would be found not guilty in one and guilty in the other. The same evidence was presented in both cases. The same testimony was presented in both cases.
I know you're in your rebuttal time, but a quick question. You're saying that Harrison does not apply here because this is a Sixth Amendment issue. What case is the guiding case on what we should do here?
I don't think that there's been a Delaware Supreme Court case or a United States Supreme Court case directly addressing the issue. I did cite cases in my opening brief that are persuasive, and I would suggest that those are controlling: People v. Mora, United States v. Murray, Rolone versus Florida, and People versus Duncan.
And what do they stand for?
They all stand for the proposition that if a defendant is denied the right to counsel or denied the right to effective assistance of counsel and subsequently testifies, that testimony is inadmissible in subsequent proceedings because they did not have adequate Sixth Amendment counsel at the time of the testimony.
Those cases narrowly focused on whether the counsel was ineffective in how he let the defendant testify?
People versus Mora was straight no counsel. That was a defendant who testified at preliminary hearing without the assistance of counsel. The other cases, United States versus Murray, was ineffective assistance of counsel, and reading the opinion is not entirely clear what the specific ineffective assistance of counsel was in each of those cases. Rolon, Duncan, and Murray were all ineffective assistance of counsel, but I don't think that the issue, I know at least in Rolon versus Florida, the opinion reads as if trial was ineffective from start to beginning of the trial, throughout the trial.
Well, here we're talking about the absence of counsel.
Right.
We're not talking about counsel that was present but ineffective.
Right. And that would be the case that I said that People v. Mora was the total absence of counsel. So there are cases with total absence of counsel and ineffective assistance of counsel, both of them ending in the same result, that if there's no counsel, ineffective assistance of counsel, and I would suggest to the court that it should be a bright line rule when someone is denied the right to counsel, that their subsequent statements and testimony are inadmissible at a second trial. And this court's already made a determination that Mr. Drummond did not effectively waive his counsel. So I would argue that the proposition of those cases that I cited is that the testimony becomes fruit of the poisonous tree from the point that the defendant was denied the right to counsel or effective assistance of counsel, and everything after that is inadmissible.
If the defendant had been making the same statement to a police officer and said, "I don't want a lawyer," would it have been admissible?
I think that's when you get into the Fifth Amendment issue versus the Sixth Amendment issue, and where you have to distinguish the Fifth Amendment case and Harrison from the Sixth Amendment cases that I've cited. I think it's a different rule. It should be a different rule for Fifth Amendment versus Sixth Amendment violations. It's a different factual
circumstance. Yes or no? Is it admissible or inadmissible under the Sixth Amendment if this had happened in the context of a police interview and he said, "I don't want a lawyer"?
It would be admissible because the person would be properly waiving, I would imagine, their Sixth Amendment right to counsel when they say they don't want an attorney. I think it's a different issue.
Do you want to save your 3 minutes?
Yes, Your Honor.
Good morning again, Mr. Chief Justice, Justice Berger, Justice Ridgely. May it please the court. I'll just address the first issue since that was the only issue that was previously addressed. But if the court has any questions about the second issue that's raised in the briefs, I'll certainly try to answer those. In this case, this is a constitutional claim that the accused, Dallas Drummond, trial testimony from his first trial in 2010 should not have been admitted at his second retrial in 2011 because of the violation of the right to counsel rule. That's the assertion being made. Prior to the retrial, defense counsel did file a pretrial motion to exclude the accused's 2010 prior trial testimony, except in the situation for impeachment purposes. That is, if Mr. Drummond had again taken the stand at his second retrial, then the defense was certainly willing to allow his testimony to be used for impeachment purposes only. The trial judge at the retrial had a discussion with counsel prior to opening statements about the motion and made a ruling prior to opening statements at the retrial. The trial judge, in his ruling, I think it's quoted at page 810, talked about the United States Supreme Court decision in Harrison, and he discussed that, and he said the focus really from Harrison is not did somebody make a knowing and voluntary waiver of counsel, but why, and the judge said that was really a two-pronged issue as he saw it, and he thought that the trial judge, that is, thought that the why in this case, the answer to the why question posed in Harrison was that first, Mr. Drummond did want to testify contrary to his counsel's advice, and that was the reason that he fired counsel after the state's case in chief was completed. This is the first trial now. And he also wanted, Mr. Drummond also wanted to testify apparently in a narrative fashion. He didn't want to be limited to simply answering questions from his defense counsel and responding to the state's questions, if any, on cross-examination.
Did everyone agree? Did trial counsel agree that Harrison was the proper test?
I don't think it was disputed that Harrison was the proper test.
Was any other test urged to the trial court?
I don't recall there being any other. I think I included the discussion with counsel. I think it's a B1 through B5 of the state's appendix.
I guess another way of phrasing my question, was this issue that a different test other than Harrison fairly presented to the trial judge?
No, I don't think it was, Your Honor. So I think we're probably in a Supreme Court Rule 8 situation that it wasn't an issue that was fairly presented. And I think Harrison is the proper test. Excuse me, I'm sorry.
Excuse me, I was going to suggest that you raise the podium or adjust the mic.
It's hard to hear. I'm sorry. I know I speak softly. I'm sorry. I realize it's being recorded, too. No, I think Harrison is the proper test, and what you have to focus on is why an accused would waive his right to counsel and choose to testify contrary to the advice of counsel in this particular case. In Harrison, the situation was that Mr. Harrison had made a prior statement that apparently was illegally obtained, so he was facing a prior statement of himself, an incriminatory statement that was going to come in, even though in truth it should not have come in because apparently there was some constitutional issue there.
Well, couldn't Harrison, as applied to a Sixth Amendment question, be viewed slightly differently as saying that when we can have to consider why the defendant testified, the why doesn't have to be because there was inappropriate or inadmissible testimony that he was trying to rebut. It also could be that he testified because he didn't have an attorney that was telling him not to testify. Now, I understand.
Sorry.
I understand that he had an attorney who told him not to testify.
Correct.
But the attorney left the scene, and we held that was after an inadequate waiver of his right to counsel, and then he goes ahead and gives damaging testimony. Isn't that pretty much parallel to the situation where somebody has to rebut other evidence, so feels compelled to testify? Here the person wasn't rebutting other evidence, but was testifying in a way that was damaging without the benefit of counsel.
No, I don't think the result's any different whether you analyze it as a Fifth Amendment self-incrimination right or a Sixth Amendment right to counsel. I think you still have to look at the motivation. There wasn't another statement that was coming in that was illegally obtained, as was right. Harrison. That wasn't in the offing, as the trial judge pointed out. So I think the motivation is still the key point, whether it's a Fifth Amendment analysis or a Sixth Amendment right to counsel analysis. And I think it's the why question there, and the judge properly answered
well,
that.
All right, maybe I should phrase it differently. If Drummond had been given adequate information and had made what this court would consider a knowing waiver of his right to counsel, and then he goes ahead and says whatever he says, that's one situation, and I think nobody would question that testimony could come in. But here he gave up his counsel without fully understanding how serious that decision was and what the consequences might be, and he goes ahead and makes a damaging statement when we could infer that if he had counsel at that point, perhaps his counsel would have convinced him not to testify or convinced him to testify in a less damaging way or in some way made his statements less prejudicial. And he didn't get that opportunity because he didn't knowingly waive his counsel. So isn't it a parallel situation to the one that was addressed in Harrison?
No, I don't think so, because here what we have is the trial attorney in 2010, the original trial, definitely told Mr. Drummond not to testify.
Right.
That was his advice.
Right.
And then at that point, the state's case in chief had been completed. I think there were five witnesses testified for the state, and defense counsel cross-examined all those witnesses, and then it was the defense turn to put on any case they desired to put on. Defense counsel, and I think this is clear in the record, did tell him not to testify.
Right. There's no question about that.
And then Mr. Drummond still wanted to testify, and secondly, he wanted to testify in a narrative fashion, and for that reason, I think he then says he wants to go ahead and fire his attorney so he can talk to the judge and the jury as he sees fit, and that's what he did.
Right, but what I'm getting at is maybe a finer distinction here. I think the record is clear that he wanted to testify. His attorney said, don't testify. And then he fires his attorney, right?
Correct, yes.
And it turns out that when he made that decision to fire his attorney, he hadn't been given adequate information to make a knowing and voluntary waiver of that right, at least according to the decision that remanded it, right?
Yes, that's correct. They hadn't gone the Briscoe factors and those things.
So don't we have to start from the premise that at the point at which he said, I want to testify, my attorney doesn't want me to testify, I want to get rid of my attorney, if the colloquy had been conducted appropriately, there would be an opportunity that he might have said, oh, all right, I'll stick with my attorney, at which point whatever he might have testified to after that, even if he still insisted on testifying, would have been likely a different version, a more sanitized version of what it was he had to say. Shouldn't we make that assumption?
Well, I don't know if you should make that assumption. I mean, what his version was that the four state witnesses against him were all giving false testimony, and that even though some of them were relating things that he had said himself, I mean, that was his assertion, was that all the state's witnesses are lying, I'm telling you the truth, and this is what didn't happen. So that's what he wanted to present, and he wanted to present it in his own fashion. Now, probably he wouldn't have volunteered had he had counsel some of the other incriminatory things, that he was a felon and had been in the system before, and but that could have been raised on cross-examination, his prior record for impeachment anyway. So I think he would have ended up in the same circumstance before the jury. His criminal record would have come in.
Although in the second trial, he didn't testify at all, correct?
Correct. He did not.
So shouldn't we take from that if he had kept his counsel in the first trial, he wouldn't have testified?
I don't know. It's difficult to predict with juries. Juries, you know, one jury hears a case and they decide it one way, another jury hears it another way. And looking at the two results that are different, he gets acquitted of the most serious charge in the retrial, the burglary. And one of the things he says is that he couldn't burglarize his own house. Mr. Drummond says that. And I think that must have had some effect upon the jury in the second trial, was that, well, okay, he's not on the lease, and this is public housing, and yes, he's not even supposed to be on the property, but his wife and children do live there, so in some sense, it's his house. And, you know, maybe reasonably, you can't burglarize your own house, and that's the only logical way I could figure out why the second verdict differs from the first verdict.
Well, I wasn't asking why the verdicts differed. What I was asking was whether we shouldn't have to assume, since in the second trial he did not testify, that in the first trial there is at least a likelihood that with counsel he would not have testified, even though it all started because he said, my counsel doesn't want me to testify and I do. But if we assume that a proper colloquy had been undertaken and the light goes on and Mr. Drummond says, all right, I guess you're right, I should have counsel. And then he sits down with his counsel, and his counsel in some way limits or directs what it is that he testifies about in the first trial. Should we assume that there would have been a different result if he had thought through and been told about what he was giving up in the way of right to counsel?
No, I don't think that inference can be drawn. I think Mr. Drummond was very adamant that he wanted to testify at the first trial, and presumably by the time of the second trial, after he'd been convicted of everything the first time around, he saw the wisdom of his counsel's advice. But he definitely rejected it in the first trial. I mean, that was clear that he did that.
Is it clear from the record the extent to which his adamant decision to testify in narrative form was driven by the fact the advice he'd gotten from his counsel was don't testify, and B, that counsel wasn't prepared to ask him questions if he rejected that advice and nevertheless wanted to go forward with his testimony? What extent does that issue come into play?
Well, I think there are two different motivations there. I don't know that there's a record about exactly why he wanted to do it in narrative form. He just kept saying that he wanted to be able to talk to the jury and the court in whatever fashion he desired, but there wasn't an indication in the record, as I recall, that it was because his counsel was unprepared to question him. Counsel had simply told him not to testify, but and then Mr.
Well, there's some suggestion, at least in the briefs, isn't there, that one of Mr. Drummond's problems with counsel and his irritation with counsel to motivate him to fire counsel was the fact that while they differed on whether he should testify at all or not, if indeed his decision to testify was controlling, his counsel wasn't prepared with questions to ask him if he took the stand. So he was left with the narrative option only. Is that an unfair reading of the record?
Well, I don't know if it's an unfair reading, but I don't know if the record substantiates that. I mean, I think it's just kind of hanging out there as to exactly why he wanted to do it, but that was apparently his preference also, that he wanted to testify in a narrative form and that he knew if he had counsel, he wouldn't be able to do that. He would be limited to answering questions. And
Mr. Williams, jury at the retrial convicted Mr. Drummond of theft by false pretenses, and criminal trespass third degree. Hypothetically, assuming there was a Sixth Amendment violation, was there sufficient evidence apart from the alleged inadmissible testimony to convict him and to sustain the conviction?
Yes, I think there was. I mean, even if you just take out his testimony from 2010, he's still going to get convicted. There's three witnesses, Brandy George, who's a neighbor of Kia Peterson, the complaining witness, Kia Peterson and Detective Dunning, and those three all testified that prior to trial, Mr. Drummond had admitted to them in various circumstances that he had entered the apartment and stolen the computer. The fourth prosecution witness, James Wesley, is an individual who is the victim of the theft by false pretenses, and he purchased the computer, the stolen computer, from Mr. Drummond in Dover, and he ID'd Mr. Drummond in court as the individual who sold him the computer. In fact, when he bought the computer, he actually asked Mr. Drummond to see his identification, so he knew who he was, even though he apparently had not met him prior to the transaction. So I think if you look at all that evidence, he was going to get convicted. It wasn't a close case, whether this other evidence came in or not. So I don't know ultimately if it makes any difference or not, if you employ a kind of harmless error analysis, I guess, here. Or if there's any other questions about the first issue.
My only question on harmless error is, if you have a Sixth Amendment violation, can the error be harmless?
No, I don't think it can. That's why I say if you employ it. But I think there's case law that says you're not supposed to use a harmless error analysis if it's a Sixth Amendment right to counsel.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'll be very brief. I only have 3 minutes. Just present the argument in a simple logical syllogism. This court previously reversed Mr. Drummond's prior conviction from his first trial in 2010. You found that a Sixth Amendment violation had tainted the first trial and overturned that conviction. So it would follow that things that happened after that Sixth Amendment violation, if we were to bring in his testimony that occurred after that Sixth Amendment violation, that the same thing that tainted his first trial, the Sixth Amendment violation that tainted his first trial, the same taint would be brought into the second trial.
Is that just for his testimony or for all the testimony? Let's assume one of the witnesses who testified was unavailable. Would that taint apply to that as well?
Well, I think as a factual matter, in this case, the only things that happened after his denial of the right to counsel was his own testimony and closing arguments. If we took your example and say that he discharged his counsel at the beginning of the state's case in chief, I would argue that everything after the denial of the right to counsel, if it tainted the first trial and you bring in it at the second trial, the same constitutional violation that tainted the first trial is going to taint the second trial.
So the only time he was deprived of counsel was when he testified and in closing argument?
Yes. Yes, he discharges counsel prior to the defense case in chief.
So there's no argument there was inadequate cross-examination of the state witnesses in the state's case in chief?
No. That's not the argument. The argument is that there should be a line that's drawn where this court found the previous Sixth Amendment violation in its 2010 case, and that everything after that is tainted by that violation. If you were to bring his testimony in the second trial from the first trial, if the first trial was tainted and his Sixth Amendment rights were violated to the extent that his case was overturned, then you're just bringing the same taint back into the second trial by the trial judge allowing his first trial testimony after the Sixth Amendment violation.
I take it his retrial, if he gets one after today's hearing, is limited to what he was convicted of in the second trial?
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.